It is Wednesday, February the 12th. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in today. So I am back with another kick-ass recovery story. But before we get to that, I, of course, wanted to make sure that I thanked the patrons of the podcast. And there's actually a new one as of this past Friday, which is cool. So there's three new patrons that have started within 2020, I guess is what we would say. And as a reminder, patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. There's actually 24 patrons now, which is awesome. So your favorite podcast, hopefully it's this one, or at least I've cracked your top 100. Your favorite internet show, your favorite online comedian, YouTube show, different things like that. These things all cost money. So essentially, it is a monetary amount to help keep the lights on. So as of this past Friday, Victoria, welcome to the group. Thank you so much for becoming a patron of the show. Wanted to thank Chad and Anthony and Jennifer and Eddie and Jenny and Sean, Christina, Ross, Holly, Caroline, Julie, Casey, Alyssa, Sarah, Adrian, Brian, Kristen, Stan, Sarah, Helen, Arnie, Barb, and Kim. Thank you all so much for putting forth some contribution to the podcast. This certainly does take a lot of work. I'm booking interviews all the time. Actually, I'm now booked into the third week of March, I think it is, maybe even the fourth week of March at this point, with interviews. There's a lot of things that are coming up in the next few months that are going to be really cool. With that being said, this is a longtime listener of the podcast, Tara Smith, who is up in Sitka, Alaska. You'll hear in the show, my Alaskan knowledge is very limited scope, but we talk about Alaska and kind of her venture through the world of chronic pain. We get into some of the dynamics around family as well, and I think that you're all really going to like this interview. So it's relatively long, so we're going to keep this open very short, but as always, thank you from the bottom of my heart so much for joining me week after week and listening to this podcast. So if you have any questions, comments, concerns, anything that you want to send me, eddie@themindandfitnesspodcast.com. You can leave an iTunes review. You can join the Facebook group, the Deleters of Pain, really whatever it is that you want. I am looking forward to connecting with you, and here is Tara. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein, and on the line with me is Tara Smith, calling from allegedly a tiny town in Alaska. Tara, are you there? Can you hear me?
I am.
It's funny. We're in that... everybody that lives outside of the West Coast, I think, thinks that Washington is also in Alaska, mm-hmm. that upper left part of the globe. What town is it that you're in?
I'm in a little town called Sitka.
Oh, I feel like I've heard of Sitka. Is it that small?
It's an island with 9,000 people. You have to fly a plane or take a boat to get here.
Damn. What do you do for a living that has you out there?
I grew up here, so I got into public safety dispatching at the age of like 22, I believe. And I did that for 11 years. And then I had a kid, and that changed things. My husband was also in law enforcement, so he stayed working as a police officer. And I did some storage facility stuff so that I could stay at home and raise my kid. And then I've just recently gone back to public safety dispatching, but I also manage a barn full time as well. So I'm pretty busy.
Yeah, you are busy. The only things that I generally know, it's ironic that you say your husband's in law enforcement, because the only things that I really know about Alaska are Alaska State Troopers, which I used to watch a lot of. And then what's that show? Northern Exposure, which actually was filmed in Washington, but takes place in Alaska.
Right.
Because my parents watched that a ton when I was a little kid. So that's my...
So did mine.
Yeah, that's my knowledge right there.
Gotcha.
And it was taped in, I think it was called Roswell, something like that. Because I've driven by the mural that appears in the opener of that show before. So...
Gotcha.
That's what it is. But thanks so much for joining me. You know, the reason that we're having this interview today, so we started talking about 4 months ago, and you had sent me a DM and had just said, hey, I'm willing to be an interview at some point and kind of talk about my story. And one of the things that really caught my eye is you said that you would be willing to talk about not only recovery, but also pain med addiction. And so that's one thing that I want to get to in a little bit. But I want to start with what sort of pain issues or symptoms it was that you had, when basically they got too big to ignore. It's the way I like to phrase it.
I would say that after having my kid, I had a C-section and I had a traumatic labor story. You know, I know now my own fears put me in that position, but it was after having my baby that all of the chronic pain set in. Neck, back, went to a doctor. They say, oh yeah, you have herniated discs in your neck. You have spinal stenosis. You have degenerative disc disease. You have the all over body fibromyalgia pain, pelvic pain as a kid, all sorts of stuff. And that's when, I think it was like right around May of 2015 when I was first put on medication for the pain.
May of 2015?
I believe so.
Okay.
Might have been 2014. I might be a year off on that. I didn't bring notes with me today, so I don't have my timeline, but.
No, that's okay.
It was right around there.
That's okay. I'm getting like a little bit of feedback, almost like a, it sounds like something is like being scratched on.
That would be the rain. I'm sitting in my car. So you're hearing the rain on the window, I think.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to edit out that part when I asked about it. But since this is weather and this is the way it is, and a lot of times I film in the car too, and I live in a very rainy climate, so I get it. Fibromyalgia, pelvic pain. There's actually a woman I was talking to on Instagram just last night who has terrible pelvic pain, and her story's nuts. And one of these days I'll share it, but she's kind of still in the draws of all that. So, what year did you have your son?
2010.
Okay, so it started getting really bad a few years after that, and that's ultimately when you were put on the pain medication. So, you got all the diagnostics in the world, and I always like to know, like, what is the how did you eventually get to, okay, you're sitting in an MRI tube or you're meeting with a specialist or whatever this case is, and then somehow you end at like the, you know, the end of that road is, oh, there's this book and or there's these concepts or there's this app or something that's brain related. How did you get there?
I had a panic attack December of 2018 when I was at the barn with three loose horses, and I didn't believe panic attacks were real. I was one of those people that assumed, ah, they're just overreacting, until I had one and thought I was having a heart attack. And it was that day that I felt like a walking zombie. And it was like, I cannot live my life like this another day. And something took me to a computer and I typed in something about chronic pain, and Nicole's was the first one to pop up. What is this?
The panic attack is interesting because, it's a symptom imperative thing. And at least like when I talked to Dr. Dave Hanscom on here, and he's had both the terrible back and the terrible knees and all that kind of stuff, but he's also had the anxiety and the panic attacks. And he says the anxiety and panic attacks are 100 times worse than any of the physical pain that he had. And so was that like the first experience that you had with something like that occurring, where it was an anxiety issue?
Yeah, I never thought I was an anxious person. I mean, traditional nerves, you're going to a dentist appointment or something, but never anxiety until that day.
Right.
And then I kind of had to start picking it apart and like, what the hell is going on?
So you found Nicole's work, and shout out to Nicole Sachs. I don't even know if she listens to this regularly, but she's been on the show 3 times and I adore her. When I have a,
as do I.
Yeah. When I have like a really like a shitty situation with like my kids or something, she's among the first people that I text that I need help. And, she's talked us out of a couple of pickles. So, shout out to her. She's wonderful. So, So you looked at her book, or you looked at her work, and what was it that she said that because her, what she talks about is like spondylolisthesis. She talks about a lot of other things, but that's like back pain and physical pain is a lot of what her book is written about. And so what was it that was in her content that said, oh, maybe this is the thing for me?
Well, she's got that little line on her website that says something along the lines of the pain is not in your head, or the pain is not in your head, but the solution's not in your body. Mm-hmm. And then she's got all those little pickup line things like the give yourself a gift of curiosity and how long do you want to suffer and choose what hurts worse versus what hurts, you know, those types of things. All of those little things kind of drew me in and made me curious. It's like, what do I have to lose to read this, to try this? I'm not doing anything. I'm in the comfort of my own home,
right.
You know. Education, and I just started it there, started with her YouTubes, did the 28-day challenge, and of course I'm one of those people that's like, oh, I don't need the program, oh, I don't need the program, oh, I don't need the program, you know, TMS personality right there. And then February 1st I was like, forget this, why am I wasting my time, just start doing it. 5 days into the program was my first day pain free, so it was like, wow, that's awesome. I knew there was something to it.
So remind us about the, tell us about the, because I remember when she did the 28-day challenge, and she actually has an active video on her YouTube channel. If I can remember, I'll link it in the show notes. But what is the 28-day challenge?
She just challenges you to journal speak for 20 minutes a day, followed by 10 minutes of meditation, patience, and kindness for yourself for 28 days consistently.
So I can see the easy trap there as you get into day five, and it's your first time pain-free in years. How did you get to writing day six, day seven? Or did you continue writing day six, day seven and doing all that?
Like I said, I did almost the full 28-day challenge until I felt like I wasn't getting anywhere. And that's when I bought the program for the guided specific what to write about. So I think it was just how she had it set up. I did speak to Kim Guillory on the phone right around that time too.
Yep.
Because somebody had told me about the different locations in your body could mean different things. And so I had a conversation with her about it. She told me to write about the male figures in my life, my dad, my brother, who was currently living with me at the time. And that was that's what I wrote about the night before waking up pain-free. So I kind of give her some credit to point me in that direction as well.
I did a podcast with Kim Guillory. You can find that available in the archives. It's probably around 8.
I've listened to every single one of your podcasts.
Well, that was a pitch for people listening too, but it's probably right around like episode 80-ish. So if you want to go back and hear some of what she talked about. So it sounds very Louise Hay to me. Some of that stuff. So, interesting. So almost using like a body diagram, and that interview with her was so long. I feel like that was even like her and I might have recorded that in the middle of the summer, but like almost like a body's diagram to say, hey, this is what it is. That's interesting. So, but you had pain in so many different areas. And so how did you account for, you know, having this one issue? Let's say that issue is focused on your back, but you know, the neck might be something entirely different and the pelvic pain might be something entirely different. Did you start journaling and writing about these particular areas or situations that were linked to that? Or did one seem to be good enough?
I think I had some pain relief prior to actually starting the program, as in like you wake up in the morning and your joints are stiff and you feel like you're 80 years old and you're going to fall over, and those types of things went away first. And I think it was that lingering neck and back pain that I seriously had for 30 years since I was 10 years old that was the last thing to go. And so I think that conversation with Kim that day was just like the icing on the cake for that final release.
Did you hear about Kim through my podcast, or did you hear about her before?
She had posted on one of the message boards on either yours or Nicole's or somebody's Facebook group, and I had it just found it from there.
Okay. And whatever it was that she was saying resonated with you.
And her response was like, you can call me, with her phone number. Like, hell yeah, I'm calling you.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. Gosh, in Alaska and Kentucky, you two couldn't be further apart. Or maybe she's, right. Maybe she's from, she might even be from Louisiana. Actually, I think
she's
Louisiana. So that's even further away from you. So, you know, you kind of get to that, you go through the program and you start writing about these particular things and the pain is like washing away. Maybe this isn't the right word for it, but maybe describe maintenance work, quote unquote.
Maintenance work is only required if I wake up in the morning and I feel the stiffness in my neck. Mm-hmm. And for those that have been to a chiropractor, you get this feeling in your body, like, I know that adjustment's going to make a lot of noise. So sometimes I get that thought in my head of, if I went to the chiropractor now, I think that there would be lots of places, but I don't need it anymore. That's my, oh, you need to get back to journaling. And after your podcast that I listened to yesterday, it's more about, oh, what am I thinking about? Yeah. Where are my thoughts? Am I creating this situation currently?
Yeah. And by the time this airs, people might not even know what you're referencing, but it was the one with Teresa Walding. And she was actually the second person who has come on the podcast to talk about the three principles, which more or less, it's not that their frame of mind or their thought is anti-journaling, but to them, it's that all this stuff is really a production of your thoughts. And Hannah Studley, who was the first person I had on to talk about it, she survived two pretty vicious attacks in Manchester, where her neck was broken and she was beat up and kind of, you know, left, not necessarily for dead, but left in a bad way. And, you know, she had the herniated disc and the broken vertebrae and all this kind of stuff. And, so a lot of these stories are just, they're pretty nuts. But with you, I mean, even though the imaging had something where they like, they could point at it and say, this is the thing, you know, the disc herniation or whatever, it was more or less you woke up one day and it just started, right?
I can tell you the very first time I felt pain, I was in the sixth grade in a gymnasium sitting on the bleachers watching girls play basketball. And I had this extreme stabbing, shooting, painful numbness, like you describe it with any words you want, ripped through my left shoulder. And I sat up straight, really. I mean, I remember it vividly. I was like, what the hell was that? Well, looking back now, I was watching a girl play basketball that I'd been riding horses with previously when I had gotten embarrassed when I fell off the horse. And subconsciously, I was reliving that embarrassment while she's playing basketball. And I'm sitting by myself. There's nobody around me. I'm not talking. It's that my thoughts right in that moment were, who did she tell? Who else knows? I'm so embarrassed. Those types of things. And that's the first time I got that intense pain. So as soon as I found Nicole's work, it was like, wait a minute, I remember. Maybe this is legit.
So this is a really interesting thing. It's so perfect that you just said this. I was thinking about this the other day, and then my buddy Brad posted something similar. But I think sometimes the pain reactions happen so fast, and when you're in the moment and you know nothing about the mind-body connection stuff, that you think that there are, you know, it's like probably at the time you may have been thinking it was because I fell off a horse the other day, or because I was, or because I was, you know, whatever the case is. And so that's kind of what you pin it to. But thinking back all these years, like in that moment, you know that you were thinking about something that happened, like you either relived something or you were. And Brad posted the other day, he was saying, I was deadlifting today and I started to, or he said that he felt like a twang in his back suddenly, and he said that he, in that exact moment, he caught himself remembering that he was thinking about something that was either that he was thinking about for the future or something he was thinking about in the past. And when he kind of had that realization, it sort of went away. And so it sounds like that's kind of what was going on in that point, or in that moment, that you're, even though you're watching this basketball game, you're zoning out, your thoughts are really elsewhere.
Yep.
Which it's just, so I guess, like, you know, maybe reconcile some of this for part of the problem of doing a show like this for 110 episodes or 115 or whatever it is that I get so entrenched in trying to explain these things over and over and over. But, you know, you're somebody that it's your first time on here, and you're talking about a thought really dictating this real, very physical pain that you probably could go and get an MRI of your shoulder, and it probably would have been all fucked up. To people that are listening that are maybe a little skeptical, maybe explain how you reconcile in your mind that you had this thought about a shitty situation and you start having physical pain. Like, how can you make sense of that?
I think it's just learning the knowledge, learning the brain science stuff. And like, you read something and then you know it in your body to be true. So there's just no question in my mind, like being able to pick that first situation. Now later, you know, 30 years later, here I'm learning about the science, and I'm a why person. I want to know the why about everything. So I make those connections on purpose. Why did this happen to me? You know, which is where I found that, oh, look, you're playing victim mode. Another reason that I had pain.
Yep.
I was a victim to my pain.
Yep.
But looking back now, it's like laughter. I have to go back to laughter again. I laugh at myself. I laugh at the things that I think about. It's like, everything that I think about is based on something from my past, based on what I know. And a thought is not a fact. So knowing I can control my thoughts by, wait, was that a random thought or was that a fact? I can like bring my body back to peace almost. And so seeing those connections, like I said, I've got 30 years of them. So now I can pick back through, like, pelvic pain started when I was in an abusive relationship. Ironic? No, probably not. You know, I can see all of those connections now. So being open to them and open to the idea that your thoughts control more in your body than you have any idea that they do.
There was somebody I was talking to last night, and I'm going to try and not reveal anything about who it is that they are, but it's not somebody that you know, or that probably most people listening to this would even know. But they were telling me about this chronic pelvic pain that they've had, or this pelvic pain issue that they've had. And they're very concerned. So they're talking about going to get imaging studies done, and to try and answer the questions. They'd asked me, do I feel like imaging is really helpful? And I said, there's a really great book called Overdiagnosed that talks a lot about the diagnostics have come so far in the last 50 years, whether it's diagnostics for cancers or diagnostics for your back or diagnostics for ultrasounds or MRIs or whatever. But the cure rates aren't necessarily any higher. And in a lot of cases, maybe they're even less. And to me, what that speaks to a lot is fear. And they started telling me about how, when did the pain start, was kind of my, you know, my initial question. What was going on, let's say, in the in the little while before it kind of thing. And their boyfriend at the time, and this person didn't know that any of this stuff was going on until her boyfriend was arrested. But her boyfriend was arrested for triple homicide, and, you know, gets arrested, has this horrific thing happen to them. And that's when their pelvic pain started, was when their boyfriend was, you know, they had no idea that the boyfriend was living a double life. And I had said, okay, well, think about it like this, that this person that you, you know, have likely a pretty serious relationship with, probably are sleeping with, that Schubiner had told me that really, like, a lot of times the pain will take you in the most vulnerable spots to really get your attention the most. And so, people that have some kind of an issue, either in like a relationship, or it could be like a sexual relationship, or it could be a sexual assault. Like, there's a lot of things that kind of fall under this, but that pelvic pain could be what is a result down the road. And I just started thinking, like, this person that you're really intertwined with in a very romantic way has committed this horrific crime, and you're trying to reconcile, how did this happen? How was I sleeping next to this person and they did all these atrocious things? And I said, that's what I would think of. I'm like, you can go and get imaged, but you could probably image just about everybody and there's going to be something that comes up. I mean, 70% right. of 70% of the population walking around right now with no back pain has a disc herniation. And that's like, that's a fact. Like, those journals and those studies are out there.
Yeah. You interviewed Julie and asked her that question too, about, did she see a correspondence between, you know, intimate relationships and pelvic pain? And she said no, which I thought was really interesting.
It was, and it was a little counter to, what Schubiner had told me, but, you know, the experiences are each to their own. And I think there's also something right. to say about, you know, a physician in a medical environment versus a, you know, versus a therapist. Like, if you think about Schubiner, if he has somebody in his office for 3 hours or whatever, they're going around and trying to rule out a lot of structural things. And then here's some things to think about. Here's this book. Write about these things. Go see this therapist, whatever. But it, to me, it comes nowhere near where somebody like Julie may have somebody in their office for, you know, once a week for 8 months for an hour a week. Like, that's a lot of time and excavating and really deep talk that's happening. So it could be, I think maybe it's more that she gets to, she's going to just naturally get to a lot of the really deep rooted issues just by proxy of time.
Right. That makes sense.
So you had talked about, this like reliance on pain medication. That's something I've always been very curious about. And I want to find a therapist that, has worked with somebody with TMS, or chronic pain that had an addiction to pills and was able to kick both of these things to the curb. And eventually, if you're a therapist and you're listening to this, please message me and tell me that that's you. And I may have already talked to somebody like that, but we've never gotten to that story. So tell me about the pain meds.
Well, growing up as a child, I hated taking pills. Can't stand taking pills. Never liked anything about it. I mean, I took ibuprofen and things to try to control pain, but the physical fact of swallowing a pill is something that I didn't like. I watched lots of people hurt themselves with medication, and growing up in, you know, the 90s, it was just starting to become a thing. Stay out of medicine cabinets, watch for this, watch for that. So as an adult walking into a doctor's office and the doctor saying, I mean, what she said to me face to face was, Tara, your pain is real and I believe you. And I just started crying, and she gave me a big hug and she said, I'm going to take care of you. So it was that, what everybody wants, somebody to believe them and take care of them. And so she started with, she said, have you ever been on pain medicine before? And it was like, well, I had a C-section, so I was on hydrocodone. She's like, let's start there. I'm going to give you either one or two pills every evening as needed, but only in the evening to start. Because I said the hardest time for me was after work was over, for the time in the evening with my family. I couldn't lay on the floor and play a game with my, I think he was three at the time. I couldn't lay in bed. My husband has his own medical issues as well. He actually had to quit law enforcement because he had a knee replacement that failed that he had to have redone. But so you've got two parents dealing with chronic pain and a three-year-old trying to lay in a bed playing a game. And it was like, we can't even play with our kid. Yep. So somebody wrapping their arms around me and saying, you know, your pain's real and I'm going to help you was amazing. So I would take one of those pills in the evening and holy shit, I could lay on the floor and play with my kid.
Yep.
I could lay in his bed and read five books with him instead of just one where it had to be done. So in that very beginning, you feel like pain medicine is going to be awesome. But the downside of it is they tell you you're probably going to be on it for the rest of your life. Because like I said, I had herniated discs and spinal stenosis, all the stuff that they found in this MRI that told this doctor that was the reason for my pain. So I think I was on medication for 5 solid years, constantly the hydrocodone, but there was a a daytime muscle relaxer that was a non-sedative. There was a nighttime muscle relaxer that was a sedative so that I could sleep. There was like a medication to protect my stomach. There was an anti-inflammatory. It was like, you know, pill bottle after pill bottle.
So you're taking like pills to counteract effects of the pills also.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Thinking that I'm doing okay because a doctor that has all of this education is like, did this for me, you know? Thinking it's okay because a doctor said it's okay. Not ever realizing that the doctor doesn't know what the medication's doing to you because it hasn't been around long enough.
Yep.
There, no doctor has a plan to get you off medication. None of them do that. It doesn't exist. You got to go see a specialist to get off of it. Just so I lived on medication for 5 years. It was like I looked forward to 5:00 p.m. so that I could pop that pill. But then what happens when life gets busier and now you are going to go sit through something in a gymnasium to watch a bunch of kids perform? You don't want to be there. You don't want to sit on the hard bleachers. You want to support your kid, but it's like, I'll just take a pain pill and I'll sit on a bleacher and I'll be just fine. And it just gets to the point where you become so dependent on that medication to stop the pain. You got to take it all day, every day. And then you run out soon. And then you feel like, because I've used this medication my doctor's given me and now I'm out. So we'll just say like, you know, run out 3 days before your next prescription. Well, then you feel like you are suffering like no other for those 3 days until you can get that break in pain again. It's that vicious cycle of I need my medicine. I need my medicine. I want to feel better. I can't deal with this pain. The medicine is helping. The doctor said it's okay. It's like that vicious circle until you realize one day that I can't stop. I'm taking more medication all the time. My doctor won't give me any more. You know, you run into that thing. Now the government's involved and nobody can give you this pain medicine. And it was just, it was a hard cycle to get out of.
I mean, that begs the question, when did you get off of it after finding Nicole's work or did you get off them before that?
After finding Nicole's work. And there was somebody on her site that I actually became friends with. Her name's Jennifer. She and I have talked on the phone and exchanged numbers and all of that. And she had posted something about being off the pain medicine and how her pain hadn't increased. And that was the information that I needed. It was like, wait a minute, my pain's not going to get any worse than it is right now if I don't take medication. That was that little post that she put on that page was my little breakthrough for, I'm going to give it a try. But I think it was in my 28 day, it was January. It was in my 28 day, you know, challenge for Journal Speak. It was right in that time frame that I finally went 3 or 4 days without the medicine on purpose.
And ever since that point, because it's been a little over a year, you know, a few days beyond a year, have there been moments in the last little while? Because, you know, you had said it earlier, like you may wake up with a stiff neck and you know that means that you have to journal, but life does get in the way. And so has there been any point in that time, you know, in the last year where pain has crept up and you're like, you know, I need to, maybe you don't need to, but you're going to take some kind of a pill to sort of take the edge off. Like, what's your thought on that?
I think that in the beginning, you want to try to replace one with the other. So everybody's like, oh, try the CBD vape pens, try this, try that. There's Mayan Kratom, there's all of this, all of that. And so, I mean, I started to research it to find a replacement, but in coming to the reality of there really isn't a replacement that's going to work, you know, the acknowledgement of I don't like swallowing pills anyway, so I'm not going to do that. And of course, being a public safety dispatcher, it's not like I can go play with all the CBD products and, you know, worry about what's out there,
right,
and what's going to help. I just couldn't go that route. So
I had an interesting observation about human behavior I was thinking about last night that my wife had a really terrible, I mean, so almost every 6 months she has her back goes out, right? And years ago when this would happen, I just chalked it up to a back spasm that happened because, you know, all the excuses, sneezed wrong, picked up socks wrong, all that kind of stuff, which doesn't make really any sense. But this time when it happened, there was a lot of stuff going on. It was by far the worst TMS attack that I had seen her have where, I mean, I would watch her on her surveillance cameras leaving the house and she would be hunched over as if she was 95 years old and couldn't pick up literally like anything. And, you know, I'm telling her what to do and all this kind of stuff. And it's kind of crazy because it's like I talk to so many people around the world that suffer with this kind of stuff and I tell them what to do and they'll be totally receptive to it. But somebody in the own house has a challenge in being able to interpret that. And people are suggesting and giving her like edibles to take and all this kind of stuff. And and I'm just thinking, like, as a culture, so deeply rooted and embedded in the American culture is this idea of like, I'm going to work really hard for everything I'm going to get. And I'm going to nose to the grindstone, and I'm going to work myself to the bone because that's what the American dream is and all this kind of stuff. But at the same time, people who will say those kind of things that I'm going to work nose to the grindstone, I'm going to put in all these hours and I'm going to live the American dream, and people that want to be known as these really, really hard workers will not put in 20 or 30 minutes of work, or they won't even believe that 20 or 30 minutes of work a day will cure a very real physical issue or physiological issue. It's people would never want to admit that we're a take a pill society, instant gratification, and that's what we need, and that's all that stuff. So to me, it's like very much like talking out of two sides of the mouth. And that's been my experience that I've really been observing and thinking a lot about in the last few months.
Why is it that we don't take care of ourselves? We will ignore ourselves before anybody else, and I don't know why.
I think it's just so I this is another observation I had on my drive home from getting a haircut today, that I was thinking that so social media, I think, plays a lot into it, which is why I think these issues are getting worse. Just simply more exposure, seeing more out there in the world, seeing more people posting happy pictures of themselves and their family and the hobbies that they have and all this kind of stuff. So the inclination is that everybody out there is go, go, go. And since we're also a very comparative society and a power of suggestion society, we also will then go, 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 go. To me, there's some parallels that can be struck between what I'm describing and what Sarno would say in his book around the look or comparison of like whiplash cases in Lithuania that don't exist because it's not in the social realm. People don't talk about it. Whiplash is not a thing there because there's not lawyers that are on TV at midnight telling you to go sue everybody, and there's not people on social media telling you you need to go be checked out by a doctor ASAP, and these things could creep up 2 months from now, and sort of, you know, these mystery diagnoses and mystery illnesses and issues and stuff like that. It's just we're just very impressionable, I think. It's a lot of the issue, and so I think that the closest that we ever get to an impression being made on us that we need to take care of ourselves are hashtag self-care, where somebody's going and getting a facial, or somebody's going and getting a massage, or somebody's sitting and reading a book on their couch, which all those things are great things, but they're not really addressing what real self-care should be, which is just simply like some introspection and some reflection on, you know, what life is like and what life is about. It's a disconnection of ourselves is really how to simplify it.
Yeah, too busy competing with everybody else for the nicest car, the nicest house, the coolest kids, instead of how do I feel?
I mean, my kids are pretty fucking cool. So
mine is too. So
Prince A, who was in, I played a clip of his on this podcast a few weeks ago, but the movie All the Rage, Saved by Sarno, there's a rapper / poet. You can find him on YouTube, Prince A, EA. He says that really his life took a huge shift when he stopped comparing and competing and just decided to be. And I thought, like, God, what a great quote. And that's so in line with this thought of, I guess this is a pun intended, but the thought of thoughts really dictating how it is that our, you know, thoughts dictate feelings, thoughts are controlling feelings, thoughts and feelings are interwoven. But at the same time, those things lead to whatever your physical being or wellness is. And so if you are always comparing and competing yourself, there's not a single person on this earth right now that at the depth of their core feels that I am better than anybody else that I observe. There's not a person out there. I don't care how much money they have or how great we think that they look on the outside. They are looking at somebody else and saying that person has it better than me.
Right. Self-judgment.
Yeah, I mean, there was a conversation I was having. It's not even a conversation. It was a comment I made this morning. There was somebody in one of these TMS groups who I actually adore, I think a lot of, if this person's listening. But she was talking about going through nursing school and going through schooling in general. I think she might even be trying to become a nurse practitioner. And she had said that, she's her pain is still terrible. And she looks at all these other people in class and the different coursework that she does and just thinks that they're doing this all so freely and without problems and without issues, and she's in terrible pain and all this stuff. And I had said, well, listen, like, that may be how it seems on the outside, but in all likelihood, you're playing a poker face when you get to do your coursework or you go to classes too. And so people are probably sitting there thinking, wow, there's this beautiful woman who has several kids and somehow is managing that lifestyle of the kids at home and the working husband and somehow going to nursing school. Like, that woman's got it all, right? They can't tell that she is in terrible pain. And so I'm like, think about flipping that for a second. Those people could be in terrible pain, but they're not telling you how it is. So you think the same thing about them that they think about you. And really it's a lot of perspective, right? And that you've said it twice now on the show, cause I've made little check marks. You've used the term victim mentality twice in the last 32 minutes. And so talk about victim.
Guilty.
Yeah. So talk about victim mentality, maybe some examples or things that, maybe sort of the frames of mind that you used to have when it comes to victimization. But, I imagine now you probably still do it just like I do, but maybe you can catch yourself in the moment. So maybe break it down for us. Give us some examples.
Yeah. The self-judgment and the victim portion is something that I think was just the tape constantly running in the background. It was like, life is happening to me. I fell off a horse and that injury happened to me. That person said these things to me. And somewhere I heard, you know, life's just happening and you're choosing how you react to it. That was my wake up for, was like, holy shit, I am in victim mode. What am I thinking? I didn't even realize it. I had no idea. Becoming the victim to the shoulder pain in the evening, or I can't lay on the floor with my kid and poor me. And that's where I need the medicine. And looking at it now was like, I did the internal work on me. Now I can lay on the floor and I don't need medicine. And I had to pull myself out of that victim mode and get off the medication in order to like get my life back that I didn't even know I'd lost.
It's interesting you bring that up. It's making me think about, I've got that Time Hop app on my iPhone. So it tells me, you know, on this day, 9 years ago, you made this update or you took this video or whatever. And, four years ago around this time, it was in early January. So this was a couple weeks ago that I was watching this, but, I had been in the throes of a really bad shoulder injury in weightlifting. I was training for a competition and had like a partial dislocation of my shoulder, and it was just like throbbing for a couple of months. And I recorded this video in my garage the morning that I was going to go get an MRI. The way I had scheduled it was an MRI was going to be on Thursday, and then Friday I was going to have the appointment with the doctor where they would say, here's what the results of the MRI are and the next step. So Thursday morning, before I go to get the MRI, I had been taking painkillers and prescriptions, anti-inflammatories for 2 or 3 months by this point, every day, twice a day for 2 or 3 months. And I had said in the video, this was a Thursday morning, that I said I discontinued all my medication yesterday so that I wouldn't be blocking inflammation that could be seen on an MRI. And I wanted to basically be in the worst state that I could be going into this imaging. And I'm like, I'm miserable and I couldn't sleep last night and I've been in a ton of pain and all this. I go and get the MRI. And then I go to the doctor the next day. She reviews the imaging studies. She diagnoses me with, it was a really obscure lesion in a ligament in my shoulder and perhaps a torn labrum and perhaps a torn rotator cuff and all this. She said, so you have all of these things. And again, I'm like sitting there holding my shoulder as she's saying these things. I'm like, this is, oh God, it hurts so bad. She says, but the good news is that it would be really hard to get a lot worse. And so she's like, if you want to go back and keep doing CrossFit and keep doing weightlifting and all that and have the surgery a few months down the road, just like, you're not really going to hurt anything else. And I remember thinking, this is such a shock, because in my world of athletics and sports and, you know, professional wrestling and mixed martial arts and all this stuff, I'm watching these guys that have these traumatic injuries and they're on the operating table like that night or the day after, right? And so I thought when I would go in and have one of these things diagnosed, she would say, you need surgery now. But with her saying, you can go back and do all the stuff you were doing before, have surgery down the road, but don't really worry about it too much. It's amazing. I shit you not. I left that office an hour later and my pain was 99.9% gone. All that happened is that somebody told me, you're going to be okay. And I mean, explain that, right? Like, there's nothing structurally that she did other than tell me that you can do the things that you want, you're going to get better, those kind of things. And it reminds me of that in a little bit of a different way, but that doctor saying earlier that, you know, you can take these pain medications, you're going to be okay. But somebody having that reassurance and almost like giving you that hug that you probably really kind of always wanted.
Right.
So talk a little bit about, this is kind of like Tarantino-ing it and going in reverse, but I'm curious, like, you, there's a couple things that you've said, one of which was that, a lot of your pain issues started after becoming a mother, and parents listening to this, I think that you can identify with that. And you'd also said, like, sitting in a gymnasium and having to take pain meds because, you know, you want to support your kid, but at the same time, like, you don't want to be there. Like, you'd rather be doing something else, which, again, parents listening to this, I can totally identify with that. Talk about how the, you know, your perception of parenting requirements, you know, you're still going to have to go to that gym. You're still going to have to go and interact and do things that you don't want to do. So how can you reconcile it now and not have it escalate and create pain problems for you?
Right now, I just go back to living in the moment. But prior to that, let me tell you that I was one of those, like, super strong-willed females. I'm never getting married. I'm never having kids. I'm never having a shared bank account. Of course, those are walls I put up to protect myself. Luckily, my husband broke through two of the three walls. We're married and I have a kid. We still don't have a shared bank account, but I didn't want to be a mom. My husband had three adult children and decided that we needed a child together. And the day I took that pregnancy test and told him about, like, I was bawling my head off. And he says, I thought we wanted this. And my response was, I thought I still had time to change my mind. Because of all of the pelvic shit that I had dealt with in my, you know, early 20s, mm-hmm. I didn't even know if I could have kids. And he said, well, I bet if you stop taking that birth control pill, you'll lose those last 10 pounds you can't get rid of. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. So I get off the pill and I'm knocked up the next month. Like,
isn't that how it works?
So I had shame and I had guilt and I had just all of the, I don't want to be here. This isn't the life I chose. You know, I became victim of my own damn choices. I made those choices, but I wasn't willing to accept it in that moment, you know? And I think I just built on that. I built on that. This isn't what my life is supposed to be like. This isn't what I chose. This, looking at it now, that's all bullshit. That is the life I chose. That is those choices I made. I love my child. I love my husband. I'm glad the life went this way, but I was so hard on myself back then. And then it's, I need everybody to know I have a good kid. My kid has the best manners. He has clean clothes. I don't need childcare. Like, again, all of the self-judgment that I put on myself in those totally made all of the pain around the C-section scar, all of the pelvic pain, the back pain, the, you know, the weight of the world on my shoulders feeling. I know where it all came from now, but looking back, I was in my own little, like, Tasmanian devil spiral doing all that shit to myself and not even realizing it.
I mean, the energy expenditure internally for all the things that you just described sounds so massive as I listen to you describe it. And a couple things that jump out at me too, one of them you said, one of them you didn't, but maybe you can enlighten me a little bit, is the whole experience of, like, going through birthing classes as a dad. So I'm not the one that's going to be bearing the child. I'm not the one that's going to be having to push a kid out or have a C-section or whatever. I remember my wife would make, she would maybe make little comments, or we would overhear little comments being made that sounded so, I'm afraid, from her perspective, I'm afraid people may judge me for this thing, or other people saying that they would judge other people for this thing. But one of them was the implication that if you don't have a natural childbirth, you're a bad person for whatever reason, which my wife took the drug. She was happy. That was fine. It, you know, it is what it is. Like, they distribute those out and it, you know, it is what it is. She also had two C-sections. So both of our girls had to have one, but I remember that there being kind of this weird, like, I even felt it coming from my mom, where, like, if you have a C-section, it's not the right thing or whatever. I have a neighbor that kind of had that same implication too, that if you have a C-section, it's bad for some reason, almost like shaming in a little way. Like, I mean, do you have any color? It's totally not TMS related, but do you have any color or context on why that may be a social thought, that A, having drugs during childbirth is a bad thing, and then two, that having a C-section is a bad thing?
I've heard some of that. I didn't have the stigma. Mine was an emergency C-section because my child had collapsed lungs. We didn't know it at the time. But I think that my fear of a C-section put me in this position because I had an old story in my head from high school when one of my friends had a baby our senior year about how they strapped her hands to the table when they cut her open. So as a, like, 19-year-old girl, that's super scary.
Oh yeah.
Now here I am, I'm 30. I have no other stories between the one I had at age 19 and the one I'm about to have myself. I have no feedback in the middle to tell me I'm going to be okay, to make this okay. So for me, it was the fear of being strapped to a table and having a child pulled out of me that was like, oh my God.
To be clear,
nobody prepares you for that.
Yeah, like to be clear, your hands were not strapped down, right?
No, they were not.
Yeah,
there was a very loose material piece over it, just as a reminder for my hands to stay open. But no, I wasn't strapped. I could get my hands at any time I needed them.
Yeah, because I mean, I'd have to ask her, but I don't think Jenny's were. I don't think they were at all. I mean, there's no pictures where it has her face and her hands in the OR, but I don't remember any situation like that. It was certainly different than, you know, when you watch a movie and there's a childbirth and the screaming and all that kind of stuff. None of that stuff happened. But yeah, the first baby Zoe, like, Jenny was in labor for 39 hours. And I remember thinking, like, there were no comments after the fact of, oh, you had a C-section or anything like that. But I remember before people saying, like, sort of implying that it wouldn't be good. But I was thinking afterwards, I'm like, her water broke more than 24 hours prior. She's been in labor for 39 hours. What else do you want to do? Like, do you expect somebody to really sit there and continue to deal with that until this baby eventually makes their arrival? By 39 hours, Jenny was 3.5 centimeters dilated. So there's a long way to go. And I don't know how you could possibly expect somebody to keep just chilling.
Well, and I was on day 4 of being at the hospital by then. They told me my amniotic fluid was low and they were going to induce me on July 13th. And I didn't have my baby until the 17th. So I was there the whole time.
That's wild. yeah. And Zoe was like, she was 2 weeks late, and then it was a scheduled C-section because they had just said, it was a scheduled delivery. So we went in, took the Pitocin. The doctor assumed that Zoe will be out in a few hours. It just never quite happened that way. And it, right. You know, it's kind of the way she is now, sort of drags her ass around the house sometimes. But, I want to go back to the question about, you know, the idea of like basically living in the moment, kind of how you're so fresh off of a lot of this stuff that you could probably pretty easily talk about what your life was like in, let's call it like mid 2018 to now, but just the day to day. Cause I think that one thing, especially parents who kind of have, I think there's a lot of people that are in sort of this like chronic pain TMS understanding where they get it and they have some reduction in pain, but they still have painful moments. And so they see this one-to-one correlation of they have a stressful moment. So let's say like your kid does something you don't want them to do and then your back flares up or whatever. How can you unwind that? Because I think that the assumption is that my kid needs to not act that way, which is almost impossible to do. Or it means that I need to go and sit in the hot tub or go and relax or whatever and try and play this teeter-totter balancing act, which I think is like impossible to do in a 24-hour day. Because we've got to make meals, we've got to sleep, we've got to go to work, we've got to take care of a kid. Like there's just not enough hours in the day to try and, I feel like, balance things like that. So how can you do some mitigation in the moment now? Maybe give us a couple of the things that you do where you're, 10-year-old boy, I only have girls, but 10-year-old boy acts nuts and acts out or whatever now. Like, how do you stop in that moment?
Well, in 2018, it would have been, I would just scream at him, yeah. You know, what the hell are you doing? The old me, the bad parent in me would have just reacted. But now it's easy for me to take a breath, pause for a moment and decide if it needs a reaction. I mean, if it's dangerous, there's no hesitation. But if it's him pushing his dad's buttons or struggling to get his chores done because he's thinking about other stuff or, you know, depending on what it is, it's like a lot of it is a choice on what's the best reaction I can give him so that it helps him because it's no longer about me. That was my distinction, was my kid, my ways, my all of that control thing. TMS has a control thing to it too. And I think I was just trying to control him too much. Whereas now I don't even try to control myself. You know, I try to live in that moment, focus on breathing. Nothing else matters other than my conversation with Eddie right this moment, yeah. You know?
Yep. I mean, that's a thing that I really have to have a lot of repetition with to try and decide. Like, a good example was a couple days ago where normally in the morning I'm getting Zoe dressed and I'm doing her hair and I'm brushing her teeth and I'm all this kind of stuff. And she said the other day, I want to dress myself. And I remember in the moment, like literally the words were about to leave my mouth. No, I need to do it. I need to make sure that you're wearing the right thing. But instead, I just said, go for it. And she, you know, it's January 22nd at this point or whatever the date was. And she put on she had a St. Patrick's Day t-shirt on. She had a Christmas sweater on. She had unicorn pants on and then unicorn boots on, but they were all different colors. And, you know, she looked like a Starburst packet, which, you know, right. Whatever it is, what it is. And I just said, like, I thought she looked great. Like, you know, she looked out there and she looked wild and all this kind of stuff. But I remember thinking, like, right when that finished, I was like, God, that literally just made my morning so much easier to just let her do that thing. And she was also very happy and proud that she had so much autonomy.
Right.
So I don't know. It was definitely like a light bulb moment where I was just thinking, like, there's so much control that we sort of all want to attain and have all the time, but it's probably doing more. In fact, it is certainly doing more harm than good. Because the thing is, like, we can also jump back into the competing and comparing conversation where, say that I did dress her, but then I get to school and there's a little girl who's wearing a similar outfit who I feel like, you know, looks a lot cuter than Zoe does. Then I'm like, oh God, like, that dad did a better job with her hair than I did. You know what I mean?
Right. Comparison. Yep.
Right. As opposed to just, like, you know, letting go and it is what it is.
Yep. Well, and so you imagine my son who grew up, you know, first portion of his life with both parents on pain medication. Well, not in the beginning, but for a while, two parents with TMS personalities, and he's got it himself where he needs his own control. So letting go of that morning routine is hard.
Yeah, definitely. I'm watching there's a FedEx driver that I think is about to ring on my doorbell. I thought he was about to ring on the doorbell, and then my dog would start barking, and you know, the whole thing would become a little nuts. What's your husband's one interesting thing that you said to me in chat a couple months ago was you'd asked if I'd ever thought about interviewing my wife for the podcast, which yes, I have. We just haven't done it. Maybe that'll be the big 115th episode or something like that. But your husband's known you a long time. So what is his take on what it is that happened with you? Because, like, that's quite a transformation / metamorphosis.
I wish this was a conversation I could have in depth with you, but my husband doesn't believe any of the shit that I've done, unfortunately. He's on his own chronic pain journey in his own way, and this last year was hard for both of us. You figure an injury cost him his career, so sitting in self-loathing for him hasn't come all the way around yet. He's still sitting in it. I am patiently, patiently waiting for him to come to the other side, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of this kind of stuff is very, it's very similar to, like, observing a friend or loved one that is entrenched in alcoholism or drug addiction, right? They kind of need to, you can try and suggest as much as you want. However, it's sort of like they need to be able to get there. Which again, like, being able to let go and just let them let themselves get there, I think can be pretty powerful. Because eventually, like, there's probably going to be, I think there's a stark difference in people that are, I actually think there's three camps. So there's the side that says, I had this injury and it ended my career and I can't do anything anymore and that's the way it is. And then there's the people that have that same situation, but they are aware of the Sarno, Nicole Sachs, TMS stuff. And then there's the third camp, which is the one that you're in and that I'm in. So he's in the second camp, which puts him at really good odds to at some point in time pick up a book or the book and say, oh, this makes sense to me, but, you know, has to be able to get there. So, you know, kudos to you for bringing it to the forefront and his forefront, because I think he'll get there at some point.
I hope so. I am not a patient person. I had a sixth grade teacher get in my face and very slowly tell me how patience is this big virtue, and I've never been a patient person in my life. So this is my finding the good in this. I'm like, this is your chance to be patient for as long as you have to be.
That's actually a good last question to end us on. One of the things that comes up quite frequently is the whole notion that, okay, people have this crazy pain issue, and then they read a Sarno book or a Sachs book or whatever, and then the assumption, even though he very explicitly says it in his books, that you don't have to change your life. Like, the first thing that I did, one of the first things I did after reading the book was quit my career of six, you know, almost 7 years, thinking that that would solve all the problems. Of course, it did not. So, you know, upending and changing everything about yourself is just not really possible. You have 30 plus, 40 plus, whatever years of conditioning and things that you think. So you're still not a patient person, right? And I don't know if you necessarily have to become a, you know, a Buddhist monk to absorb this kind of stuff. And so how, you know, tell us maybe how you're the same and how that's okay. Like, if you're not a patient person, but yet this approach has still worked for you because you haven't completely upended your life, right? You might have changed some thoughts and philosophies and ideas that you have, but for the most part, would you say that you're, a lot of the stuff is still the same, and that's okay.
Yeah, and I actually took it the opposite way and realized that because I was living a pain-free life that I could do more, and that's when I took the second job and went back to public safety dispatching And it's two completely different worlds. The person that I was when I worked there 6 years ago versus the person that I am now, nothing gets my blood boiling now. It's crazy.
I'm wearing a Fitbit all the time now. And so I thought, like, I trained and I did a CrossFit competition last week, and I thought, I always, whenever I go into these competitions, I always think I'm going to do a lot better than I actually end up doing. And so I guess I think I'm in a lot better shape maybe than I really am, at least compared to some of the other people that are competing. But when I look at things like resting heart rate and such, I would want to see what mine is. But I remember when I was in what I felt was like peak physical condition, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, and my resting heart rate at that time was like 57 or 58. But I notice now, and I wish I would have a good sample of like, just before Sarno stuff and then now, but my resting heart rate at the moment as I say this is a 46.
Nice. I thought I was good at 53.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And the thing is, the shitty thing about that, and I emailed or I texted a person who was on this show once. She's an athletic trainer in San Diego, and I had asked her, okay, here's the thing. I'm like, today at the workout that I had, when I felt like my lungs were going to explode, I hit 166. And that's the most it's ever been that I can remember, at least since I've been tracking. Let's say that I've had a heart rate tracker in front of me and available for the last couple of years, and I've never been able to hit over 165. I'm like, however, there's plenty of people that I know and work out with, and particularly female, that will regularly hit 180 or 180 plus. I'm like, so does it mean that I'm in really good shape and it's tough for me to get amped up, or does it mean that I'm in really bad? She had said that her thought is that a lower resting heart rate and a lower max heart rate is actually better when it comes to physical conditioning or whatever. But I'd be curious to know where that resting heart rate was, you know, kind of before I found all this stuff and I was freaking the fuck out every time my elbow would twinge or my, you know, my knee would feel a little discomfort. Cause now it's very much when that stuff happens, I can just say, I didn't do anything. Kind of, you know, put the logic into it.
And now you have me questioning if I had my Fitbit with heart rate monitor when I worked dispatch before, because I always tracked my steps. So now I'm going to have to go look when we're done with this and see if I have old data.
It's funny. I've got a presentation tomorrow for a bunch of executives, and I plan on looking down at it throughout it and just saying, what does it look like right now? If this guy gives me a really hard ass rejection to something that I say, is it going to bubble up? Is it going to jump up? So I might even actually press the track workout while I'm in there giving it and just see what, you know, how does this jump up and down?
So don't set yourself up for failure. Don't judge those moments.
That's
just
true.
Watch them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's well, the thing is, like, it doesn't really do, I don't feel like there's anything I could do to train. Like if I wanted to go and, have a heavier back squat, I can get on a program. I can get a heavier back squat. There's not really a training program for me to be less nervous when I go and meet with an executive or get my heart to slow down when I meet with an executive, other than just to say, we're just people. We're just two people. Right. Like,
right.
I mean, I'm definitely the only guy that walks into an office that wears a suit and has a long beard and long hair and a man bun. Right? So like, I don't think that's typical of my industry, at least.
Right.
Tara, this has been awesome. Is there anything that you want to close with? Kind of your, you know, your closing thoughts?
I just want everybody to know that there is a chance to get rid of whatever you're dealing with. Like, stop living in your head, open your eyes, realize that your thoughts can create this stuff and that there really is life on the other side of pain.
That's awesome. Those are good closing words. Tara, thank you so much for your time. But, you know, best of luck to you. I'll keep watching your journey in Alaska and ultimately how the next, you know, few months shake out. And I think, like, if you're a part of any of these Facebook communities still, being able to throw in little nuggets, I know that you do it, but continuing to throw out little nuggets of information when there's things that, you know, resonate, or there's so many things here that you've said, like, everybody kind of thinks that their story's so unique to them, but to be honest, like, a lot of our stories and our personalities are all pretty darn similar. And I think that's, you know, that's why there is a type T TMS personality, because there are common traits that people tend to have.
For sure.
Tara, thank you.
Hey, thank you. This is fun.